Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, new ideas inspired by classic literature. Last year, a class at the University of Iowa rewrote The Great Gatsby over Zoom, and they wound up with a movie deal. I'll talk with Harry Stakopoulos, who taught the class, and Haley Treem, one of the student writers. But first, more than 200 years ago, at a time when women in England have very few rights, Jane Austen wrote novels featuring strong, intelligent women with principles. Certainly, they had their faults, and of course, romance does play a central role in all of her novels, but the thinking, feeling, authentic women she created have inspired readers for generations. Andrea Kane also believes they can inspire leaders. She is director of the doctoral program in educational leadership at DePaul University in Chicago and the author of Kicking Ass in a Corset, Jane Austen's Six Principles for Living and Leading from the Inside Out. And she is on the line with me now. Hello, Andrea.
So nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And one of the main things that you are writing about and that you teach about as well is something that you call internally referenced leadership. Tell me what that is.
Internally referenced leadership is about sourcing our power from within, tapping into an internal agency and sense of efficacy, and most importantly, equanimity, no matter what's going on in our outside world or how we're being squeezed by our metaphorical corset.
Okay. And then when did you connect this idea with Jane Austen?
Well, I am a Jane Austen obsessed fan, a Janeite, as Rudyard Kipling called them. And I was at a Jane Austen conference, which is not technically my academic field, but I was talking to a colleague about how all the best leadership lessons I've learned come from each of the heroines. And at the same time, I was going through a kind of midlife divorce and trying to navigate some tumult in my own life. And I realized that being a leader in my own life and having an internal locus of control was also something that I learned from Jane Austen. So I brought that back to my students. I spoke about it at conferences, and the rest is history, literally.
Well, it's interesting. In recent years, there have been a lot of different things done with Jane Austen's work. And one that I think is the most interesting was a group of Jane Austen fans that sprang up in Pakistan. And these were women who really felt like they didn't have much control over their own lives. And although it had been 200 years, were really taking a lot of inspiration from these novels where women who didn't have a lot of rights, didn't have a lot of control, were still finding agency within themselves. So have you been following along as maybe our interpretation of Jane Austen becomes more and more feminist?
I think that's so true. In reading Lolita in Tehran, it's the same thing. And I do believe that Jane Austen kind of was, a precursor in some ways to what Viktor Frankl talked about during the Holocaust, that we can perceive ourselves and our situation from our own perspective, irrespective of how the environment views us or devalues us. And there's huge power in that. We can talk about dismantling a patriarchal society, but we also can start by dismantling the patriarchal constructs that might be in our minds. And I think she followed Mary Wollstonecraft, who talked about that. And I think she's very inspiring. And there are a lot of very modern revelatory layers to her.
In your book, you break this down into six different principles of leadership, six novels, six heroines, and six different principles of leadership. And in a way, you pull out the moral of each of these novels, because there is a moral in all of the novels that Jane Austen wrote, which some people may not notice because they're so much fun. Did you feel a little anti-fun, maybe breaking it down and just pulling out the moral center of the books?
I think that's true. I mean, it was very interesting for me when I had a couple of offers from these academic presses. And one of the reasons why I was so excited about Jim McCoy and Iowa Press is that he saw that this was deep and real and meaningful and not just a light, fun cocktail book, you know, that was cutesy. So for me, there was this moral core and this moral center. And I definitely feel that, you know, there are a bunch of Jane Austen and leadership fans that have loved it. And other people are like, wait a second, this is supposed to be a lighthearted romance. You know, you're my buzzkill.
Well, maybe they weren't paying that close of attention.
Exactly.
Read it again. And of course, you start your book with Elizabeth Bennet. You had to either start or end with Elizabeth Bennet, the heroine of Pride and Prejudice and the most famous character to ever come out of a Jane Austen novel. And I do want to play a line. I pulled this from the BBC production of Pride and Prejudice. This is one of the most famous lines from Pride and Prejudice. There are many famous lines, but this is one that you quote. It's from my favorite scene in the book where Lady Catherine de Bourgh comes and tells Elizabeth that she cannot marry Mr. Darcy, and Elizabeth refuses to answer her questions. She refuses to reveal whether or not she is engaged to Mr. Darcy. And here's really the final climax of that conversation from the BBC version.
You are determined to ruin him and make him the contempt of the world.
I am only resolved to act in a manner which will constitute my own happiness without reference to you or to any person so wholly unconnected with me.
And this is your final resolve? Very well, I shall know how to act.
There is Elizabeth Bennet standing up to Lady Catherine de Bourgh. And that is a line that you find inspiring in teaching about leadership. Tell me what it means to you.
Oh, that is, first of all, one of my favorite adaptations, Jennifer Ely and Colin Firth. And that line, I think, contributed to me calling this internally referenced leadership. So that was the keystone to my whole theory and my whole book. I think it's so incredible that here this woman without a dowry, without any aristocratic connections, will say, you know what? It doesn't matter what you think of me. It doesn't matter what society thinks of me. It doesn't matter how I'm intentionally or unintentionally devalued by you. I value myself and I look at myself independent of that social construct lens. And I think it's really key. I also think it's so interesting. You know, people who haven't read Jane Austen talk about the romance side of things. And I spoiler alert, Elizabeth Bennet says no to Mr. Darcy, who's one of the most eligible bachelors in all of Regency England. And it really shows that she has this self-actualized view that's independent of everyone around her. And I think it's really powerful.
And I think it just bears repeating again that this is a book that was published in 1813 for the very first time. So this is a character who, and those lines were pulled straight from the novel. This isn't a modern interpretation of Pride and Prejudice that we were listening to there. It's just incredible that Jane Austen had the insight and the agency to create this character who could stand up for herself. But let's talk about the principle that you pull out of that. Again, as you said, it's about internally referenced leadership. But your first principle is that universal truths are anything but. Tell me more about what you mean by that.
Well, I think, and especially for women, and I'm 55, so I feel especially for women my age, we've been indoctrinated with all these so-called universal truths that come from other people, our families, our communities, our workplaces, other organizations. And I think we need to do a kind of what I call de-universalizing our truths, a Maria Kondo, giving back those truths that are not our own. So in that scene with Lady Catherine de Bourgh, Lady Catherine calls Elizabeth Bennet an obstinate, headstrong girl. And I always think about the ways in which I was conditioned to be obedient, to be likable, to be a good girl. And there are so many moments in my professional life, in my work life, where I want to speak up, but that voice, you've got to be a good girl, you know, says, no, you can't like shake everything up, Andrea, you need to be good. And I have to go through a process of remembering that that is not my universal truth. That came from my family. And I see now so many inspiring women and men challenging things that are wrong in society, and they're called obstinate, headstrong, and that's a good thing. They're living, you know, again, from the inside out. And I feel like that was Elizabeth Bennet over 200 years ago.
And this isn't saying that a person should be uncaring or selfish, just principled and true to oneself.
Exactly. I think, you know, one of my other principles is, you know, Fanny Price from Mansfield Park. And it's about being principled. Anne Elliot, about hard work and contributing to society and thinking beyond yourself so that you can consider the welfare of the community.
We will. So we'll explore those principles a little bit more in a moment. We are going to take a short break. I am talking with Andrea Kane. She is the author of the book Kicking Ass in a Corset, Jane Austen's Six Principles for Living and Leading from the Inside Out, published by University of Iowa Press. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. Also coming up later in the hour, more classic literature with a new twist. We'll talk about The Great Gatsby and find out about a class at the University of Iowa that rewrote the book over Zoom last year and wound up with a film deal. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Andrea Kane. She's the author of the book Kicking Ass in a Corset, Jane Austen's Six Principles for Living and Leading from the Inside Out. She's also the director of the doctoral program in educational leadership at DePaul University in Chicago, a longtime Jane Austen fan as well. And Andrea, just before the break, we were talking about your first principle, and we're going to make our way through some of the principles. Maybe we'll even get through all six. But you started with Elizabeth Bennet and that search for universal truth within ourselves. And from there on out, you are treading into territory that not as many people are familiar with, because, of course, Pride and Prejudice is the most read of all of Jane Austen's novels. So you'll have to give us a little bit more background. We're going to talk next about the principle inspired by Eleanor Dashwood from Sense and Sensibility. And tell me about Eleanor Dashwood just a little bit for people who aren't familiar.
Definitely. So Eleanor Dashwood and her two sisters and her mother have her father die. And because of the patriarchal laws of the time, they're basically banished from their great house. They don't inherit anything. and they have to radically downsize in a lot of different ways. And Eleanor is, you know, from Sense and Sensibility. Eleanor is the sense. Her sister Marianne is the sensibility. And they respond two different ways to the, you know, tragedy and the dramatic change of life. Marianne is more of a victim and is angry and upset and has lots of emotional swings. And Eleanor has this pragmatic, resilient acceptance and is in this problem-solving mode. So Eleanor stands for that principle.
All right. So she is a problem solver. She is resilient. There are some people who might say that she's a bit of a martyr, but you don't see her that way.
I do not see her as a martyr at all. And she feels her feelings. You know, at the end of the novel, she really expresses her feelings. But she's the one who keeps the trains running on time, even more so than her mother. Jane Austen tells us she was the counselor to her mother. She gets them from A to B to C. And it's incredible to think about the leaders I know, you know, during this crazy pandemic, who've been so resilient and able to problem solve and enormously creative. And I see Eleanor Dashwood's all over the place.
Well, and you also talk about her ability to compartmentalize and detach herself from the emotions of a moment. Sometimes people think detachment is not a good thing, but you feel like that can be a really powerful tool.
Right. I say this in my book, that detachment gets a bad rap. And this is where, for me, using positive psychology literature, leadership literature with Jane Austen literature was such a kind of rich, you know, prism to view this work. Eleanor is able to detach from strong feelings, but she's also able to feel them. It's just that they are not driving the bus. She's able to go to a place of witness and problem solve and not get lost in her feelings. And so I think that that is such an important nuance with detachment.
Let's talk about your third principle and Anne Elliot. She was the heroine in the novel Persuasion. And I love the title of this chapter, In Defense of Seafaring Folks with Weathered Skin. But it's really all about choosing your principles, your values over status.
That's so true. For me, persuasion is all about these very different paradigms that we see in our world today, entitlement and privilege versus hard work and merit. And you see, Anne Elliot comes from a very privileged, you know, family, and her father's in debt. The only thing he reads is the book about his own aristocratic heritage, and he has to rent his great estate to someone in the Navy who was an award-winning Navy man who's been able to really help England during the war and made a fortune doing it. So Jane Austen had a brother in the Navy, and she definitely saw that hard work and merit and being out in the sun, getting your skin weathered, which is something Anne Elliot's father criticizes, was laudable. And again, the heroine in that book criticizes her own family and really admires those who work hard and earn their rewards rather than just having them, you know, given to them.
Jane Austen's novels are not just romances. They're also really critical looks at society. And I am just so struck in thinking about Persuasion by how relevant all of this is more than 200 years later. Is it a little overwhelming sometimes how on the nose she is still about society today?
It is absolutely incredible, the layers and the levels and how on the mark she is, because I think about it all the time. I mean, I was working in a situation where I was consulting with someone who was trying to dismantle some of the entitlement in her workplace. And I thought, I was quoting Persuasion to her, you know, as a way to do it. And I think it's very, very surprising that there is so much there. And I'm 55. I think I read Pride and Prejudice when I was 14 for the first time. But I reread the novels every year, and I always discover something new.
And in your book, you also try to come up with tools that people can use. If this feels like a principle that you are not personally in touch with, you try to give people exercises that they can actually use to maybe put a little more Anne Elliot in their lives.
Definitely. For me, as a leadership professor, theory is important, but it's also really important to operationalize. And I work with groups and I work with my students and I have empowerment courses and consulting clients. And they say, okay, this is great for Anne Elliot in the 1800s, but how do I put this in my life now? And that's very, very important for me.
I'm talking with Andrea Kane. She is author of Kicking Ass in a Corset, Jane Austen's Six Principles for Living and Leading from the Inside Out. And as we go on, you started with Jane Austen's most popular and beloved novel. And I feel like I'm not going to say that these other books are not good. I personally love them as well. But you're kind of working your way down the list. Were you concerned at all that maybe some of what people consider to be her less substantive work, you weren't going to find the morals and the principles that you needed?
Well, you know, I have to say the one that I was really concerned about was Catherine Morland from Northanger Abbey. Because Jane Austen scholars will say that's the less finished work, the less mature work. But for me, Catherine Morland, who some dismiss as this naive young heroine who doesn't fit in the Austen canon, for me, she was in some ways most important because she's all about dreaming and this passionate nature, creativity, being in the moment. And I think about how I've really gotten into meditation and taking walks in nature and trying to kind of refuel spiritually. And Catherine Morland has been such an inspiration. So I do feel like I have to defend her the most.
Well, and for people who haven't read Northanger Abbey, tell us just a little bit more about her.
So Catherine Morland is a woman who goes to Bath with wealthy neighbors and meets a very wealthy family and ends up being a guest in their house. And again, she is somebody who, you know, has misunderstandings about how the mother died but she teaches the man who she ends up falling in love with about how you can look at things with a fresh perspective, how you can be out in a field and you can love a flower. And she's also very uncharacteristically optimistic, I think, for an Austen heroine, even when she's treated very badly by the father. She puts a kind of smile on it and is grateful for all she has. And, you know, one of the famous lines is that, you know, when the storm is over, you know, we can be happy again. And I think given everything we've gone through as a society, it's just a really important lesson. It's also, she's all about, for me, she loves to get lost in reading and romance novels. And I think it's very important that we have daily practices in our lives where we're refueling ourselves and we're resting and we're kind of stepping away from Zoom and maybe stepping away from the news to kind of attend to our well-being. And that's what she reminds me of.
Another character that inspires you is Fanny Price of Mansfield Park. And Fanny Price really pays a big price for her moral stance. But tell us a little bit about Fanny Price.
Yeah, so Fanny Price, I think Fanny Price is so relevant today. She, her family is poor and there are lots of brothers and sisters, But her aunt married very, very well. And so she is sent to go live with her aunt and uncle. And she's never really part of that family. She's kind of treated almost like a kind of quasi-servant. But she that ends up being her home from age 10 to age 18. And she, even though she has very little power in that family, and some people argue that in all the Austen novels, she has the least money and the least power of all, but she confronts her uncle about being involved in the slave trade. And when he tries to marry her off to a wealthy suitor, she says no. And she's banished out of the house. She goes back to her home of origin with an alcoholic, some would say abusive father. And she's willing to face the consequences. And she really speaks truth to power. And we need that now more than ever. And there's a line that Jane Austen describes her with, that she is firm in her principles. So Fanny is kind of homeless in a way. She's not at home at her home in origin. She's not at home with Sir Thomas Bertram, her uncle, but she's at home in herself and in what she stands for. And she doesn't waver. And all the people who are speaking truth to power right now remind me of Fanny Price in the best way.
She sounds like a member of Gen Z.
So true. When I think of my 25-year-old daughter, I think of Fanny Price.
Well, let's get to your final principle. And this one is interesting. And again, you're backtreading in some of the more popular novel territory with Emma Woodhouse from Emma. And that is a tale that has a kind of a heavy-handed moral, I think, in many ways. And many of us would not want to emulate Emma in too many ways. For people who haven't read it, tell us just a little bit about her.
Well, so Emma, I mean, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's such a wonderful, first line about how she's clever and has money and has everything, but thinks a little too well of herself. That's the relevant quote. Emma is very arrogant at the beginning of the novel. And she, instead of living her own life, she is this puppet master, is Henry Higgins, who tries to control and in this benevolent dictator kind of way, tries to improve everyone around her as if they are puppets in her life. She tells herself it's for them, but it's also for her own amusement. And then Emma has this experience happen where she really, she screws up a lot. I think Jane Austen said, I made a heroine who only but myself will like. but she, and there's, her brother-in-law's brother, who ends up being her love interest, is the only one who is truthful with her. His name is Mr. Knightley. And she really screws up in the middle of the novel. And he really calls her on it. And at that moment, Emma really reflects on everything she's done, all the manipulation, and she has these tears. And one of the big Jane Austen scholars, Stuart Tave, talks about how they're extraordinary. I call it her Pinocchio moment, where she becomes a real woman, a real person with three dimension, who sort of sees her flaws, owns her flaws. And it's actually a hugely liberating thing for her that she can be human and she could learn and grow. And I bring in Carol Dweck's growth mindset, and I talk about how Emma is the, the poster child for fixed mindset at the beginning of novel and then becomes emblematic of growth mindset toward the end. And I bring in the leadership literature, and, that Jim Collins, who wrote Good to Great, studied all these companies, and he talked about how the best leaders at the best companies had this level 5 leadership, which is a combination of will with humility. And so Emma really reminds me of the importance of humility as a leader of an organization and as a leader in our own life. And for me, humility has been hugely liberating because I know I'm a work in progress. I don't need to kind of take everything off. I'm never going to get there. I'm just going to be learning and growing, making mistakes and getting back on the horse my whole life, like everybody.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that a lot of us love about Jane Austen's heroines is that none of them are perfect. Absolutely none of them are perfect. And they all have the ability to learn and adjust. So that feels like a beautiful takeaway. And you also write about putting these different pieces of the puzzle together. But it feels like you don't put on too much pressure. I was worried. I'm like, we're building the perfect person. I can't be the perfect person, Andrea.
I totally hear you. I have to say, as I was going through my editing process with the different drafts, in my first draft, I said, internally reference leaders always do this. And that's wrong. You know, we try and then we see how we don't and then we shift. It's all with compassion and gentleness.
Well, Andrea Kane, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Andrea Kane is the author of Kicking Ass in a Corset, Jane Austen's Six Principles for Living and Leading from the Inside Out, published by University of Iowa Press. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald is considered by many to be one of the greatest American novels. The title character is the embodiment of the American dream. He is a Mr. Nobody from nowhere who grew up in poverty and rises to extreme wealth and success. There is a whole lot more to the novel than that. There is a lot of fodder for thought, a lot of fodder for exploration, and the book also just became part of the public domain right at the beginning of 2021, which gave Harry Stacopoulos, Associate Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of Iowa, the opportunity to have a class of 19 University of Iowa students rewrite the novel. This endeavor not only succeeded, but it landed the students a movie deal. Harry Stacopoulos is on the line with me. Hello, Harry.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And give me an idea of what this class was about and how you got the idea to have your students rewrite The Great Gatsby.
Well, I was searching for ways to put sort of traditional English class together with creative writing. And it sort of came to me that fan fiction or the idea of fan fiction might be a bridge between the two approaches. And instead of having the students say, do individual sort of fan fiction efforts on Harry Potter or Twilight or the Hunger Games, I thought, why not have them work on a classic work of literature, thereby allowing them to do more traditional literary critical work? And then I stumbled upon the fact that Gatsby was entering the public domain. I thought, wow, they could rewrite it and then put it online and, you know, have a sort of extra edge to their efforts that semester.
Well, and of course, you did this in the spring of 2021. We all know that it was a very strange school year last year. So was this a virtual class? Was this all online?
Actually, this was the fall of 20.
Oh, the fall of 20, pardon
but
me.
You're quite right. It was on Zoom, and it started in the sort of bleak days of late August 2020, if you remember.
And, I do.
Yeah, most of us remember. And I think that COVID was sort of kind of an advantage in a sense, however twisted that may sound, because we were all looking for a sense of community connection, and it allowed us to bond more effectively and produce a better rewritten Gatsby.
All right. Well, I want to bring one of the students, and she's no longer a student. She is a graduate of the University of Iowa, but she was one of the student writers that was involved in this on the line with us. Haley Treem. Hello, Haley.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And Haley, what was your reaction when your professor said, hey, we're going to rewrite The Great Gatsby this semester?
I thought it was a little crazy. I was very excited, though. I kind of took the class because I needed the credit. And I never expected it to go this far. It's been an absolute blast.
So how did you, as a class, go about rewriting this novel, Haley?
It was actually collaborative in multiple ways. So we kind of split it up by chapters, and then we got partnered in groups of two, or in one case, a group of three. And then each week, that group would write a chapter. And then as a class, we would collectively edit it and discuss how to write the next chapter.
Okay. And you had to also come up with a modern twist on Gatsby that you would all agree on. Can you give me kind of a plot synopsis?
Yes, absolutely. So at the beginning, we kind of decided that it would be, sorry, my dog is barking. We decided that it would be really interesting to have Gatsby reflect more modern times. And so we actually decided to make Gatsby a woman, but a woman who still falls in love with Daisy, as the original Gatsby does. And so in that sense, she ended up being gay, which completely changed a lot of things in the plot, but still kept a lot of the things the same.
Yeah, very interesting, because here now you have a person who maybe in our modern society doesn't necessarily have the same kind of status and power, at least not as a default, as a wealthy white man would in 1925. So you really turned it on its head.
For sure. Yes. Yes. We wrote her as gay, and we also wrote her as Black. We just really wanted her to reflect modern times and grow into her own person in this project that we were creating together.
Interesting. So there's a lot to Gatsby that is kind of a cautionary tale about the American dream and what we sacrifice for power and wealth, and maybe the humanity that we lose in that search for power and wealth. It sounds like in some ways you maybe made a slightly more sympathetic Gatsby, though. So how different does this book end up being, Haley?
Oh, gosh, I don't know if I want to spoil the end for you, but it's weird how it's very different in a lot of ways, but it also is very similar. We still had her representing that thirst for wealth and power, and we kind of really leaned into how the original, a lot of Gatsby's thirst for wealth comes from his love for Daisy, so we kind of leaned into that as well. But I think something super different about this book compared to the original is we kind of really leaned into Nick's character more. I know Nick is famous for being a peripheral viewpoint in the original, but we really closed in on him. We still kept him on the periphery, but we got very close to our Nick.
Oh, wow. So you sounds like you were really emotionally attached to Nick.
Yes, for sure.
So in doing this whole project, I mean, Harry, obviously, the exercise of rewriting the novel, of collaborating, that was your goal. What did you think the end product would be?
I didn't have that much of an idea. I was a little worried early on that the whole thing might fall apart and it would be a complete epic failure. But everyone was pretty committed and fairly driven. And again, I think staying at home and being bored probably helped, threw a little extra energy into the process. So I didn't have, my expectations were low, but when it started getting a little media traction locally and then the film producers expressed interest, I think that sort of may have given people a little extra energy and more revision was done and it was improved. So it came out looking pretty good.
So how did that happen? Film producers don't normally go through college course catalogs and say, hey, you know, this might turn into a film. How did you make that connection?
Well, Emily Nelson at Iowa Now, which is a university publication, wrote a story about the class. I shared it on Facebook. Michael Caden, a now retired Princeton professor, shared it as well. And one of his ex-students, Nicola Beardsley, saw it. She's a film producer, and she thought, wow, that might be interesting. She contacted me, and I won't go through all the steps because we'll be here forever, but that was the very beginning of the process.
Wow. Well, and then you also had a class of 19 students who had all collaborated on this process. That doesn't sound like a simple transaction if they say, hey, we want to buy the film rights to this. So that was a pretty big challenge as well, right?
Yes, we had to create, or the students had to create, because I was just a silent observer in the background. They had to create a limited liability corporation in order to sign the option, which they collectively titled or named Old Sport LLC, because Gatsby calls everyone Old Sport. And once they created that, they could sign the option, which they negotiated, as Haley can tell you, slightly better terms than those initially offered, but everyone seemed pretty happy in the end. It was a protracted process, but step by step, they got there.
So, Haley, this is so much more than you bargained for when you took a class because you needed credit. What do you think you take away from this experience?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the most valuable things for me, first of all, was it lines up with what Harry was saying about us all being bored during quarantine. I think this class, honest to God, kept me a little more sane, having a project to work on and collaborate on. And then, two, I think this helped me learn to work more collaboratively in the first place, because I am such a control freak with my writing. Like, I really like to know what's going on and plan ahead. So having to fly by the seat of our pants every week and revise and wait for the next chapter to go on to write the one after that and so forth was really good for me as a writer. I learned a lot through this process.
So in addition to possibly making it to the big screen, we know that a lot of things can happen along the way. Is there a hope that this will also be published in book form, Haley?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We're kind of looking at the book and the movie a little separately. Obviously, they're connected, but we're definitely wanting to get the screenplay out and going. But we're also really prioritizing publishing it as a full book. We're all contacting each other, like, when can we edit? Who's free when, kind of thing.
Have most of you graduated by now?
Probably about half of us, or maybe even like 3/4 of us, actually. I know some people are still in school, but most of us were juniors or seniors.
So that's just an interesting dynamic to be pursuing, I would guess, as a sideline to whatever else you're doing. What are you pursuing post-graduation?
Currently, I am pursuing a master's in library and information science. I want to be a children's librarian. I would love to write books on my own, but I don't rely on that. So I'd love to be a librarian. I know some of my peers are working in the hotel industry and some are going into publishing, and there's like a whole smorgasbord of things all of us are doing around the U.S. and maybe people have moved out of the U.S. by now even. I'm not sure.
So in writing the book, of course, you had to collaborate with each other. I'm sure there was a lot of negotiation going on about plot points and the direction that the story would take. And then you formed a company together. And I'm sure there's had to be a lot of negotiation about the direction that this project will take in the future. Was there one biggest challenge for you and the other members of the team, Haley, something that you had to overcome?
So as far as collaboration goes, I was very surprised by how on the same page we all are. We still had, like, some civil disagreements about minor plot points, like, oh, it makes more sense for this to happen or for this to happen. But on the major plot points, like, someone would put down an idea and everybody would be like, yes, sounds good, love that. So I was floored by how enthusiastic everyone was to go towards the plot we were going towards. It was just the perfect storm for all of us. Honestly, for me, the hardest part has probably been, like, scheduling, especially after we finished the class itself. It's so hard to find a time when all 20 of us are free. That's probably the hardest, like logistical problem I've run into.
Yeah, absolutely. So Harry, of course, you know, this was a great idea that you had. It has taken on a life of its own. What do you think you learned from this experience?
Well, I guess I learned, first of all, throw a compliment out there, that Iowa students are bright, you know, dedicated and hardworking. I knew that before, but I don't think I knew how bright, hardworking, and dedicated they were. But I also realized that teaching, I guess, creative writing can be more of a communal or collective effort. I've been harping on this to a variety of people, but creative writing tends to be, as Haley just suggested, individually oriented. You know, you write your own story, you find your own voice. And this was very, very different. They had to work collectively. And remarkably, there were very few tensions. Although, Haley, I do remember a sort of comic disagreement over what should happen to Tom Buchanan. Some people wanted to murder him, get in him into all kinds of, you know, horrible situations. But that was mostly just a source of amusement. And I also learned that maybe the humanities and the arts can be somewhat compatible with some business, real world, legal enterprises. All the students had to sort of become their own advocates in a kind of business legalistic manner toward the end of the spring semester when they were looking at the option. And that's usually seen as antithetical to what we do over in English and creative writing. And maybe now I realize that's more compatible than I'd originally thought.
There, of course, is always a new semester. There's always a new class of students. Are you inspired to try this again?
I'm doing it right now.
And what book are you doing right now?
We're doing The Sun Also Rises, which goes into the public domain January 1st, 2022. And we were hashing out possibilities for new plots yesterday in the lovely English Philosophy Building on the University of Iowa campus.
Oh, I may be more excited about that one just because I didn't love the original as much as I loved The Great Gatsby. But you must be looking at, you know, of course, here we're talking about Ernest Hemingway. We're talking about F. Scott Fitzgerald, two of the greatest authors in all of American history who were writing in the 1920s, which was such an incredible creative moment in our history. What else do you have your eye on for future semesters?
Well, I'm actually, it's not a novel, but Steamboat Willie, the first iteration of Mickey Mouse, goes into the public domain on January 1st, 2024. And we'll see if my colleagues find this sufficiently literary, but I sort of want to do, crazy as it may sound, a course on Mickey Mouse and Disney and creative writing. But we'll see if that actually passes muster with my colleagues. But there are other options as well. Winnie the Pooh goes to public domain soon. Virginia Woolf, other famous Faulkner novels. It's sort of kind of a gold rush for modernist and modern cultural works generally. they're all coming into the public domain.
So having had this sort of lightning strike moment the first time you did this, Harry, is there pressure on this class that's rewriting The Sun Also Rises?
Well, I've joked about that. Maybe I don't know whether the current students have expectations. At a minimum, I'm sure they'll do a great job, and we'll post it online for the public with the help of the university's digital studio. And who knows? They have some very interesting ideas concerning Brett Ashley. That's all I'll say. And it's possible. Well, I don't know. But still in the sort of, you know, incubation period right now.
All right. Well, this is a very exciting project. And Haley, I know that it's hard to say what could happen in the film world. Is there a date that anybody's been talking about when we could see your Great Gatsby on the big screen?
That is a great question. I know that we're aiming to have the screenplay done by the end of the year. We have a whole revision schedule going on, but I'm not sure about actual production. So we'll see. I'd be happy if it came out in a couple months versus 10 years from now.
Well, we will keep our eyes open. Haley Treem and Harry Stakopoulos, thank you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Charity.
Harry Stachopoulos is an associate professor of English and creative writing at the University of Iowa. Haley Treem was a member of the class that rewrote The Great Gatsby and wound up with a film deal. This is Talk of Iowa.